Welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Trump says the clock is ticking. Indeed, it is ticking for the entire world. His war of choice has changed the world forever. Also, is Europe really preparing for war against Russia? Or is it all just bluster? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guests, Aleksandar Pavic in Belgrade. He is a member of the Serbian parliament. And here in Moscow, we have Shay Bowes. He is an Irish journalist based in Moscow and Dublin. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's go to Belgrade first. Aleksandar, illustrious duo representing the United States negotiating with Iran decided that they weren't going to go. I'm talking about Witkoff and Kushner. It's probably a blessing for the world. But the Iranians are beginning to communicate their message that they are the serious people in this and that they're not going to budge. It's quite interesting. The collective West, led by the United States and Israel, have kept Iran in a box for 47 years. Now the tables have been turned. And so the American president's in a box now, and the Iranians are not going to let him out easily. Go ahead, Aleksandar.
Well, they shouldn't, of course. On the other hand, I must say that the Iranian foreign minister pretty much said that negotiations are still going on, and that he hopes that the United States can accept a reasonable framework for negotiations. Obviously, maybe there is even some shuttle diplomacy going on, because he went to Oman, and then he's going back. He went back to Tehran, I think, and then he's going to Moscow, and then he's going back to Islamabad. It's not for nothing, obviously. And they also his team went to Tehran for consultations. You don't go for consultations unless there's something going on. And let me give you a little bit of a different angle on Trump canceling the Witkoff-Kushner trip. Just maybe that's a blessing in disguise.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't think it's maybe. I think it's a blessing in disguise. Maybe, just maybe, Trump wants to consider what the Iranians are offering without the help of Kushner and Witkoff. So that might be happening as well.
Right. Or you're also saying without Israeli supervision.
Well, yeah. What was it about a month ago when they were, I think right before this attack on Iran came, I just don't remember which official, but someone characterized the two as practically agents of the Israeli government in negotiations. Yeah. So, that's I'm going by that. And I'll give you something that it's not in the media. But I know that Jared Kushner is a very big proponent of the Third Temple starting to be built as soon as possible. And we know what that means. Means no peace. Good news for the evangelical right, the Christian Zionists who want Armageddon. So let's just give a little bit of sympathy to Trump, because I don't think Trump wants Armageddon.
Well, I'm sorry, Aleksandar. It hasn't been earned yet. It hasn't been earned by long.
Okay, but I don't think he wants it. I don't think he wants it.
Oh, well, what he wants is not really at stake anymore, Shay. It's what the Iran wants, okay? Because I will agree with Aleksandar. There are negotiations going on, at least on some level here. But they're not negotiating the Trump's 15 points. They're negotiating Iran's 10 points. That's the difference here, okay, Shay?
Yeah, I think all of this kind of just demonstrates the sort of lack of a plan prior to this, as you say, war of choice. It's remarkable that even through the negotiations to try to end it, you can see that there was absolutely no cohesive plan here. There was no real objective, because that objective seems to change every 24 hours. There's no actual mechanism by which to end it, sending envoys, and the envoys that have been chosen. I mean, if you wanted to send people into to talk to Tehran, you couldn't pick worse people than people like Jared Kushner, as Alexander's just said. And that just demonstrates the sort of lack of a rudder. When the decision was made to sort of make this, as you say, war on choice, these strikes, this revanchism about what you said about destroying the nuclear capability of Iran in the first place, now that he seems to be trying to reverse out of this, the fact that it's on, it's off, and as you say, that there is no cohesive plan to end it, because there was no cohesive plan at the start of it. That's what people should really understand. And something that Alexander says about Trump not wanting this, Trump strikes me like he's a man that's driven by huge ego, okay? So even within Kushner and Witkoff, if they get too popular, it's almost a Stalin-esque vibe coming from Trump at the moment, where and also this work towards the Führer, because people around him in his cabinet, no one can advise him he's wrong about anything, it seems, like the Labour Secretary, who said the job numbers aren't so good. He got fired for saying that. So he's almost dictatorial because of his ego, not because of policy. And that's a very dangerous place to be as well. So I'd suggest that there's also an element of Kushner getting too big for his boots, being Tel Aviv's man in negotiation. It says that he's leading.
Yeah, but Shay, I think that's a double-edged sword, because they're going to be the fall guys along with Pete Hegseth. Okay, so it cuts both ways. Alexander, there's a characterization of this conflict that doesn't get much room in Western media because it's an indictment of the West. But this is an anti-colonial war on the part of Iran. I mean, this is an ancient civilization that has been put in a black box, a cage, for the last 47 years, and Iran is looking for a paradigm shift. I get really sick and tired of this language, looking for a deal. Well, the Russians aren't looking for a deal. Iran is not looking for a deal. They want the West to accept a paradigm shift. Security for everyone or security for none. And it's as simple as that. Alexander.
Absolutely. Now, I know exactly what you're saying. And let me tell you something. I have great sympathy for Iran, coming from Serbia. We were subjected to an unprovoked bombing in 1999. And, most of this public in Serbia is on Iran's side. Let's be perfectly clear. Despite the fact that Trump was probably more popular in Serbia than anywhere else in Europe, but we remember and we know what the story is. But what I'm looking at is the following. I'm looking at the bigger picture. What was the alternative? The alternative was to have Kamala Harris be the president. And let's just be clear. A few days ago, Amos Hochstein, who was a high official in the preceding administration, said that they were going to bomb Iran even if Kamala won. That was the plan, pretty much. So, what I'm seeing is the following: there is no collective West anymore. Trump is doing a great job of destroying the collective West, and while this crisis in Iran has been taking place, he's pretty much sown a deep row within NATO. He has dug a deep row. I don't think NATO can ever recover from this.
We can only hope.
I think he's doing it deliberately. So what I'm saying is, yes, this is the same old colonial imperialistic West. Yes, but I'm saying let's take what we can get, having in mind what the choice was in the American elections in 2024. And would Kamala Harris have open talks with Russia? Would Anchorage have taken place at all? No. So, I'm saying it could have been a lot worse. That does not excuse this war at all, of course. Trump was obviously sold a bill of goods that it was over in a few days, that they were going to decapitate the Iranian leadership. The people are going to go out into the street and they're going to welcome the Americans or whoever else was going to come in. And that didn't happen. So he's trying to get out of it without permanently damaging his legacy. I can see what's happening.
But let's talk about what's being damaged here. Shay, what's being damaged? Yeah. I don't care about the fate of Donald Trump, seriously, okay? But the what's going to determine the final outcome is the global economy. And this is, it's going into free fall right now. Every day that passes, it has a compounding effect, okay? If it were to end yesterday, we're going to still feel the effects of this unnecessary war of choice for months, if not years, to come. And if add another week, another 2 weeks, 3 weeks, it boggles the imagination, the damage that we're going to see. Shay.
Very good point. And it actually ties very much into what Alexander was saying. Because remember, the Americans aren't at all shy about saying, none of our energy comes through the Strait of Hormuz, right? So they start this war completely out of the blue, no real rationale for it, completely a war of choice. And then they say, you know, we're going to blockade it. And if you pass our blockade, that's illegal. Forget the fact that the war that you started, which was exceptionally illegal, but they don't really care about Hormuz. And talking about sowing a division in NATO, it's actually if you could believe that there was a rationale to this, you'd suggest that it was America trying to sow division in NATO, using the crisis they've created in the Strait of Hormuz to put pressure on Europe to be more compliant with the American empire. You could actually probably make that argument feasibly. Now, I don't believe that's the case.
Well, I think it's a derivative. One of the many consequences.
Yeah, it's one of the many consequences of it. But that's really interesting because the Americans have openly said, look, none of our energy comes through the Straits of Hormuz. If you want to fix this now, what we've started, you've got to send your Navy into the Strait of Hormuz and go into a combat situation with the Iranians, who've been proven not to be Venezuelan. They don't speak Spanish in Tehran. They didn't take the big dollar payments from the CIA and walk in. The discombobulator doesn't seem to have worked in Tehran. The Americans know that now. So it's all about this very fractious attempt to contain this Pandora's box they've opened. And the Persians know that now they are in, they hold the upper hand. They hold the cards. Because as you say, Peter, for every day that they can launch a single drone into the GCC countries, a single fast attack boat from their 2,500 kilometer long coastline out into the Gulf or out into the Straits, they can put a stranglehold on the global economy. And you're very right as well in suggesting that if there's one thing that Donald Trump prides himself on and believes he has some knowledge of, which may be true, it's about business and doing deals. So all of this is backfiring in a very chaotic way. And you can see that in the it's on, it's off, it's open, it's closed. We're blockading the blockade. No, there doesn't seem to be any plan, which makes it very dangerous for consumers in the West, but it also every day it goes on, I think, it solidifies.
Yeah, and I would add to that the Trump family empire investment into the Gulf, the Gulf countries, that's all going up in smoke. All of this is very personal for him, okay, other than not to mention all of the market manipulation, which I certainly hope one day isn't investigated because this is just outright theft. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here and we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Now, let's talk about what's going on in NATO, as mentioned in the first part of the program. Alexander, Donald Tusk really was mouthing off quite a bit last week with his interview with the FT. And, you know, if I were to take him seriously, because I don't, but if I did, war against Russia is coming in a matter of weeks. Alexander, you know, I'm not a military guy, but if I saw war coming on the horizon, I would be mobilizing the army, mobilizing the economy. No, he just kind of sat. I don't know where the interview was, but he was having an interview with the FT. I'm sure he was having a nice cup of what the Poles call herbata. There's emergency in words. His hair is on fire, but it's just bluster, Alexander.
Yes, well, you know what? These so-called elites that are ruling in Europe, most of the European Union, you know, they don't really speak for the people. I think we all know that. Yep. And what they're saying pretty much is that they're willing to sacrifice Europe in order for the deep globalist state to survive, for Brussels to survive, for the Brussels bureaucracy to survive. They need Russia as the enemy. They need to militarize the continent. They want to institute, I think, a semi-permanent or even a permanent state of emergency because their rule is slipping. They're not popular. They have to intervene in elections all over Europe in order to get the desired outcome.
Alexander, I thought it was Russia that was meddling in elections.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I forgot about Russia. Yeah. Yeah. Let's just see a shred of evidence, and then we can join the bandwagon saying Russia's meddling. I mean, come on. You must admit, you know, and I'm feeling like the Rolling Stones when they put out Sympathy for the Devil. You know, I'm saying I'm trying to get some sympathy for Trump. But I'm saying is that Tusk, Brussels, von der Leyen, they don't like Trump very much. They liked it much better when it was Biden, when it was Obama. There was this transatlantic bandwagon that we're all very happy to be anti-Russian, to goad the Ukrainians into, dying for them in an unwinnable war. And they want to keep that going. A few days ago, the Belgian defense minister literally said, we need the Ukrainians to fight until 2030 so that we can get ready for war with Russia. What is this? You know, this is like Eurasia against East Asia in 1984. You know, it's always, you always have to have the enemy. That's the only way that they can stay in power. That includes.
Yes, well, that's it. But that is the new organizing principle of the EU is perpetual war. Russia is the enemy. And the derivative effect is there can be no dissent. This is all very, very convenient. They've moved away from the promise of prosperity and security because they can't give either. And so they're flipping the script. Now they're the perpetual victim of an imaginary enemy. Shay,
spending time in Russia and in Europe, as Alex will verify, you see that the propaganda, it's propaganda by osmosis. It's everywhere. You turn on your radio in your car, it's Putin's war, it's Putin's anti-aging vaccine. And then there's drones over Belgium. There's drones over Ireland when Mr. Zelensky is visiting. Now, 3 months later, you'll see reports from the various intelligence agencies, the military, saying they weren't drones. It was a flock of seagulls. It was a fishing boat. But that doesn't matter because the propaganda has been deployed. And it's this incremental osmosis of fear. It's very much like a 1984 scenario, as Alexander again says. But one thing that I think is really interesting is the perpetual dysfunction and failure of the political elites in Europe. If you look at the people who are shouting loudest that the Russians are coming to destroy our societies, they're the most unpopular political leaders in a generation, Peter. People like Starmer, people like Macron, people like Merz. This isn't propaganda. These are the facts. It just so happens that these three men, who are very Russophobic and very much beating the drums of war, have two factors in common. They're exceptionally uncommon or unpopular. And in their countries, there is absolutely no appetite for war. In the UK, there was a recent poll where 50% of the population of military age said they wouldn't fight for any reason for the British Army. So you've got this radical wokeism within these societies, which is seen as almost a deployed tool of compliance now. It's not radical to be pro-LGBTQ. It's mainstream now. It's radical to stand up and say, well, I'm not really interested. As in Serbia, as in Hungary, you see what happens to countries who do that. So it's a mixture of absolute political dysfunction domestically, this backfiring of this wokeism, which has become mainstream rather than dramatically different to anything else. It's now dramatically rebellious to say, well, I'm not into that. I'm not turning up at your parade. That has become radical. So they flipped the whole script. And as you talk about interference in elections. I was pulled off a plane in Romania by six armed police officers, deported because I was about to report on what was about to happen in the country. All has come to pass. It's been proven that I was right. I'm taking it to court in the EU now about that. So dissent against this manufactured reality is also, there's antibodies to free speech, to dissent. And the EU is becoming the Soviet Union without the great free education, the space program, the free libraries and the great cultural institutions. It's become the worst of the Soviet Union, while in Russia, we're free to say exactly what we want. It's a remarkable situation.
You know, Alexander, in the wake of the Hungarian election and the defeat of Viktor Orban, the Brussels elite, they got a figure in Hungary that will be pliant, and now there was agreement that 90 billion euros. It's called a loan. I'm not sure who's going to pay it back, because Ukraine will never pay back any of the money that has been loaned, and putting the Europe on the hook for that, which of course, the Russians will pay for it after they lose in this war, which is just, again, unicorn thinking here. I mean, not only does the European Union betray all of its, the essence of its reason for being, now they're just putting the population into essentially debtor's prison.
They don't care.
They don't care.
Just to continue, everything Shay said, I totally agree regarding the atmosphere in Europe. And I remember him being pulled off the plane. He's going to be something one day, because, if he was in prison, he would be president, I think, in a year or so. But I think I'd vote for him.
Nelson Mandela. Okay.
Yes. But, look what they're doing. This is how much they don't care. Finland wants to be able to import nuclear weapons onto its territory. That's deliberate provocation that's going to expose whom? Well, the Finnish populace, the average Finn. What did Poland and France just do? They had military exercises where they actually practiced nuclear targeting of targets in Russia. How about that? Do we really think that either Poland or France can counter Russia as a nuclear power? No way. But it's the populations that are going to be targeted, because the Russians have to target them now. In Poland, would the average Pole want that? I don't think so. But this is the elites. These are the elites who are playing with the lives and the future of their own populations, whom they purportedly represent, but they really don't. Because if we had truly free elections in the EU, I think they would all lose. But we don't have truly free elections in Europe, and they're trying to make sure that we never have free elections within the EU ever again with this, democracy shield that they're instituting, these so-called these digital barriers, policing teams, policing the social media, et cetera, for politically incorrect talk. They're turning the EU into a big armed camp. I won't say concentration camp yet, but they're on their way of doing it. So by 2030, we're going to have an armed camp called the EU facing Russia, who did not threaten any of them, but will be forced to prepare for any contingency. And that's exactly, I think, where that's the future of the EU, who just a couple of years back could still sell themselves successfully as the most successful peace project in the history of mankind. Doesn't that sound funny
the EU got a Nobel Prize for peace, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, I can't disagree with Alexander at all. I mean, what's remarkable about a project that began talking about the European Union as a very wise and very capable.
Noble.
noble, absolutely. Yeah. It was a great idea. And many sovereigntists like myself, and I suggest both of you, think we need to reverse back towards, away from nation building, away from sort of militarism, towards cooperation in the movement of people, maybe to a lesser degree, also in economics. Go back to the EEC, away from EU, where you have this dictatorial, non-elected, essentially, Eurofuhrer, Miss von der Leyen, who has a remarkable cascade of dramas behind her, I've been writing about, but also talking about this drumbeat of war and how it's this distraction, as Alexander was talking about. I've been writing about a guy called General Sharif, which was, he was the deputy commander of NATO, a British general, who predicted in 2015 that the British army would have to go into Syria to beat ISIS, ISIL. He predicted that, got that completely wrong. In 2017, he predicted that the Russians were imminently about to assault the Baltic states, imminently. In 2017, it was coming, got that completely wrong. Now he's the senior advisor to Mr. Sirsky, the Russian-born general who's running Mr. Zelensky's army for him. So this stumbling forward, this you know, failing to the top, there doesn't seem to be anybody sort of challenging this politically, militarily, in any way, because the only plan they have in the EU and in NATO, and by default, you know, across the sort of ecosystem there of the elites, is escalation, because they're praying that Russia will assault Finland. They're absolutely praying for this casus belli to happen. Imagine that being the case. They're hoping, and these provocations, they're praying that Moscow will attack them. I don't think the Russians are going to take the bait, Peter. I certainly don't believe they will.
But we've rapidly run out of time here, but I agree with both of you here. Their currency right now is escalation, and that is madness. We saw what had happened, what's going on with Iran. I want to thank my guests in Belgrade and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.